From BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcasts, this is Year of the Bowie, a podcast series that tells the story of David Bowie. I'm your host, Andy. If you haven't listened to the first six episodes yet, I would recommend giving them a listen before proceeding with today's show. If you like what you hear on this month's episode, I would love if you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Year of the Bowie. Up to this point, I've referenced this as an eight-part series, but based off of the pace that we are currently going through Bowie's life, I suspect that there might be an extra episode added to focus in more on the times he spent in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. If you've listened up to this point, I'm sure you won't mind. Now let's get back to the story of David Bowie. In January of 1977, off the heels of his recently released album Low, David Bowie moved his rehabilitation recording team of Iggy Pop, Tony Visconti, and Brian Eno to West Berlin. The idea behind the move was to find a place where they could live in peace, separated from the celebrity lifestyle and the drug culture. Here's David talking about the move to Berlin.
I wanted to have another kind of friction, and so I went to Berlin, and I found the friction I wanted.
What was that?
People living under the impression that everything might collapse very quickly. And people are very serious there and don't care too much for flippancy. Mm. It's a very tight life there, surrounded by a wall with machine guns, which is ever coming in on you. Mm. The more you live there, the longer you live there, the more it comes in. And the wall, by the end, feels as though it's right around the apartment or house that you're staying in. Mm. Thematically, I've always dealt with isolation in everything I've written, I think. So it's something that triggers me off. It always makes me interested in a new project if it has anything to do with alienation or isolation.
Here's Iggy Pop discussing the impact of the move had on David's addiction.
There was a lot less doping going on. He was living over an auto parts store with no central heating. So everything becomes a little more basic, a little more homemade by of necessity.
Another inspiration behind the move to Berlin was Bowie's fascination at the time with German Expressionism, an art movement based on expressing emotions rather than the external world. The womb of Berlin allowed Bowie to focus on his music and even his newfound love, painting. Here's Tony Visconti talking about David's new creative outlet.
David would just sit in his flat and smoke and paint and write a song.
I think he wanted to make sure he was continually doing something productive and creative. He was always thinking that way.
Well, I know I'm a good writer. I'm not sure about putting my paintings in. They're very personal to me as well. They're all portraits, and they're all portraits of people in isolation. Most of the paintings are Germans or Turks who live in Berlin, and they're either from East Berlin and who are now living in West Berlin and knowing their families are on the other side of the wall. And so I try to capture a lot of that kind of isolation. And I put a lot of myself into the paintings as well. They're very much part of me.
The first order of business was recording Iggy's second solo album, Lust for Life. To help bulk up his sound, Iggy recruited Hunt and Tony Sales, two teenage brothers that could bring in a more youthful spirit to the sound. Bowie had less involvement in the making of the album, although he would have a lasting impact on what would go on to be Iggy's most famous song.
He grabbed a ukulele one afternoon and started at it. He said, "Now, call that Lust for Life," which I imagine he'd probably gotten from the movie of the book of the painter. And Kirk Douglas doing Van Gogh doing torture, self-torture, which fit the artist he was recording.
He's gonna do another striptease. He may As Iggy put the final touches on Lust for Life, Bowie began constructing songs for his next album, Heroes. Many of the lyrics from this time period reflected the defiant feelings David felt in Berlin, a place where you always felt like you were being monitored. One day while struggling with lyrics for a new track, he found himself in the position of a voyeuristic monitor, observing Visconti outside the window with backup singer Antonia Mass.
One day he did announce that he had the lyrics written for Heroes, but he needed to, you know, write a few more verses and all that. And on that day, Antonia Mass, who sang on backing vocals on Beauty and the Beast on the Heroes album, she was in the studio. And David couldn't concentrate with us in the studio, so he said, "Would you two mind taking a walk?" And I go, no, okay. And really, it's not a great place to walk around that area of Berlin. It was, you know, they had this vacant lot with a gypsy encampment behind it, and then the wall. We walked around the back of the studio where we could actually see the control room, and I guess we were visible too, because Antonia and I shared a little kiss by the wall, or close to it. So we go back to the studio, and David is smiling. And so is Coco. Coco Schwab was there. They're both smiling. They had kind of like a cat who ate the cream kind of smile on their face. And I said, what's up? And they said, well, we saw you. Saw me. He says, yeah, we saw you kiss by the wall. And it made it into the song. You're in the song. He went, wow. You know, I wasn't expecting that.
The sight of Visconti and Mass sneaking a kiss would inspire the story within Heroes, a sort of Romeo and Juliet tale of two lovers separated by the Berlin Wall. When Brian Eno heard the melody and lyrics, he knew that David had come up with one of the best songs he'd ever written and decided to pull out all of the stops. He ended up calling King Crimson's Robert Fripp to contribute his guitar playing to the song. Here's Fripp discussing that surprise phone call.
I was at home in my apartment in New York, Waterside Plaza, in July 1977, and the telephone went. It was Brian Eno calling from Berlin. He said, "Hang on, I'm here with David Bowie. I'll pass you over." And David Bowie said to me, "Do you think you can play some hairy rock and roll guitar?" I said, "Well, I haven't played guitar for a while. I'm not sure, but if you're prepared to take the risk, so am I." Shortly afterwards, a first-class ticket arrived on Lufthansa to Germany. So, in 3 days in Berlin, I played all my guitar parts on David Bowie's Heroes. Now, keeping up, little guitarist from Dorset, keeping up with characters and artists of the quality of David Bowie and Brian Eno, you have to be quick.
Here's Visconti discussing the contributions Fripp brought to the classic song.
Robert Fripp laid down three tracks, not knowing the structure of the song yet, but he had this lovely idea and was playing with his feedback control by stepping on his measured distances between the note he was playing and where the speaker was. So you have Fripp moving back and forth, playing this part, and you have Eno going like this with the little synthesizer and doing this and all that. So let's just play that. It's no ordinary guitar sound. And I know you can't buy a pedal like that that'll sound like that. That's done by two very smart people. So what we did, we had it played over three tracks, and no one track was good enough. So it was my idea. So if you play it, Aaron, please. So we have this. We have this. See, he came in later there. Different sound. Then we have this track, three tracks. Now they're all very pretty, but they were meaningless until I threw them up like this. Three, the three together. And I had to do some judicial mixed balancing in the mix, you know. But we always had this constant frip thing going all over the place, like it was like a celestial frip sound. Okay.
Bowie took a break during the recording sessions to play keyboard on Iggy's Lust for Life tour. Tickets sold out quickly when people heard David Bowie would be there. But instead of seeing the star perform front and center in small clubs, David remained behind his keyboard, singing backup vocals for the tour. Fortunately, Iggy's stage presence didn't disappoint.
There was something with Jimmy that I hadn't seen in rock and roll, which was a kind of a method. I can't explain it. A method poetry. It was an unleashing of parts of the animalistic kinds of rock that you never really see. It's always usually safeguarded and very, very safe.
And sometimes
and Jimmy
programmed
excited me
yes,
what he was doing.
Yeah.
I've never enjoyed a tour as much as I'm enjoying this one, just playing keyboards, because I think it's as fulfilling as any of my tours.
When Lust for Life was finally released, the album suffered due in part to the death of Elvis Presley. RCA focused all of its efforts into printing and promoting his back catalog for mourning fans. Fortunately for Iggy, several songs on the album would gain fame decades later due to appearances in movies like Trainspotting and commercials for Royal Caribbean Cruises. Bowie returned from the tour re-energized and excited to put the finishing touches on Heroes. While he had been gone, Visconti and Eno had been noodling away on the unfinished tracks, resulting in an album with even more new wave ambiance. This can be best seen on the album opener, Beauty and the Beast, another song exploring the dueling forces separated by the Berlin Wall. Much like the album Low, Heroes would have a B-side containing a series of instrumental tracks with a strong influence from German bands like New and Kraftwerk. Bowie even dusted off his old saxophone for several of the experimentations. To promote the release of Heroes in late 78, Bowie did his usual run through the talk show circuit. His friend Mark Bolan, who had fallen on hard times in late 77, was now hosting a TV show in Granada. Bowie agreed to help his friend out by making a stop along his media tour. After a performance of Heroes, Mark joined David on stage for a closing jam. It would be the last TV appearance for Mark Bolan. Tragically, he died a week later in a car accident.
Thank you for goodbye and all the boys in the band, David, everybody, all the cats, you know they are. This is a new song.
1, 2, 3, yeah!
Fortunately, the friendship between Bowie and Bolan ended on good terms. After recording the episode, the former rival spent the afternoon catching up, playing guitar, and even writing a song together. A bootleg of their song Madman would be later discovered and covered by the new wave band Cuddly Toys. As a testament to the duo's long-standing talent, the track would crack the UK charts. As can be seen from any interview from this media tour, Bowie emerged from the Berlin sessions a new man. Not only did he look different, with a clean-cut haircut, his addiction had also subsided. Here's an interview with David in 1996, talking about the impact of his sobriety on his life.
I mean, at a personal level, you don't do drugs anymore.
No, absolutely not.
And you don't drink?
I don't drink either, no.
Not even a glass of wine or anything?
No, it would kill me.
What do you mean it would kill you?
I'm an alcoholic, so it would be a kiss of death for me to start drinking again. And my relationship with my friends, my family, everybody around me are so good and have been for so many years now, I wouldn't do anything to destroy that again. Yeah. You know, it's very hard to have relationships when you're doing drugs and drinking, for me personally anyway. You become closed off, unreceptive, insensitive, all the dreadful things that you've heard every other pop singer ever say. I was very lucky that I found my way out of that.
Bowie's clarity resulted in him focusing more of his energy on his son, Zoe, who at that time decided to change his name to Joey, or his given name, Duncan. With an extensive world tour coming up in a few months, Bowie moved his family to Montreux, Switzerland, a charming tax haven where he could provide his son with some normalcy. In the months leading up to the tour, David tried to make good on the lost years, spending most of his time with his boy and even exploring kid-friendly projects that strayed far outside the wild days of Ziggy Stardust. This might help explain why, in the winter of 1977, the once eccentric, gender-bending rock god appeared in a cardigan sweater on Bing Crosby's Merry Old Christmas. The result is one of the strangest holiday moments in rock and roll history.
Hello. Oh, I'm David Bowie. I live down the road.
Oh, I'm Bing.
Oh, I'm pleased to meet you. You're the one that sings, right?
Well, right or wrong, I sing either way.
Oh, well, I sing too. In fact, I've got a 6-year-old son, and he really gets excited around the Christmas holiday thing. This is my son's favorite. Do you know this one?
Oh, I do indeed. It's a lovely thing.
Here's backup singer Robin Clark and guitarist Carlos Alomar discussing the strangeness of Bowie's Bing Crosby appearance.
We just thought, I can't believe it, you know. David Bowie with Bing Crosby. What a marriage.
Bing was made more contemporary by it, and at that point, David wanted to diminish his role in the whole kind of underground, renegade, you know, lifestyle.
Our finest gifts we bring,
sadly, this would be Bing Crosby's last TV appearance. After the deaths of both Mark Bolan and Bing Crosby, Bowie joked that he should probably stop appearing on television. Around this same time, Bowie would also have kids as his target audience when he narrated for the London Symphony's recorded version of Peter and the Wolf.
The cat thought, the bird is busy arguing. I'll just grab him. Stealthily, she crept towards him on her velvet paws.
As the relationship with his son improved, the relationship with his wife Angie was falling apart. During the recording of Heroes, the couple had agreed that they would get a divorce. Here's Robin Clark's insight on the split.
A lot of things happened that were pretty unsavory as far as arguments and disagreements and, you know, just turmoil in their relationship. And David didn't want to expose his son to that.
At first, the decision had been amicable, but when she chose to spend the holidays in the United States partying without even calling home to her son, David took Duncan into hiding. When Angie arrived in Switzerland to find her son and husband gone, she ingested a lethal dosage of sleeping pills and woke up the next day in the hospital. The suicide attempt empowered Bowie's lawyers to argue that she was too unstable to be in charge of a child, and it worked. By the end of the divorce proceedings, David would have full custody of Duncan, and Angie would be given a meager settlement. Here's Alomar and Visconti discussing the fallout from the divorce.
At a point in a marriage, you have to take a stand. You're either going to go with it, or you're going to say, this has got to stop. There was a time when everything had to stop for the sake of Zoe.
The open marriage was now closed. You know, he said, I've moved on. He totally became both parents to Joey, and he was great.
Bowie would use his world tour as a means of escape from the tabloid scrutiny in 1978. Despite his series of uncommercial albums, he was still selling out stadiums off the heels of hit songs like Heroes and Sound and Vision. Plus, the release of his greatest hits album a year earlier didn't hurt.
Well, you walk on past. Your lips got a smile on your face. To the cage, she wants her beauty in a cage. It was too. Someone's backing down and chipped it out. I just got a black and out. Japanese you blow into my arms and stay. Weather's grim, ice on the cages.
Bowie returned to Switzerland after the tour finished in late 78, and he began working with Eno Visconti and future Talking Heads guitarist Adrian Belew on what would be the album Lodger. Recording sessions were tense, with the Bowie-Eno dynamic starting to crack. David wanted to have a more traditional drum and guitar approach, while Eno wanted to continue in the soundscape-driven direction they'd taken on the two prior albums. This tension resulted in the duo coming up with innovative methods for creating unnatural sounds by using live instrumentation.
What we did was took the basic idea of Susie Q, reversed it, and sort of played the idea of Susie Q backwards. And then Brian decided to put prepared piano on it. So he put sort of pairs of scissors and all kinds of metal things on the strings of the piano. And that's where, how you get that thing. That's all piano. I think a lot of the stuff that we write, we've got maybe five or six different systems we use for writing material now. And we find more systems every time we do an album, which is very much... I'm very influenced by Brian on that particular aspect, which is the cybernetic use of music, which is the use of systems. Put one system with another and see what happens.
As a result of this more organic approach, many tracks on Lodger feature a tribal sound. Guitarist Belew said of the album, Lodger was a world record, urban and eastern at the same time, incorporating world music styles. For me, it was perfect preparation for working with Talking Heads.
African nightmare, one time Mormon, Mormon, fallen, hullabaloo, and I slept in the nearest bar. And the man chairman went too far. Bent on a windfall, went a stony wonder how the dollar went down. Gotta get a word to Elizabeth Father. Hey, oh, we wish me well. Seems like an everyday I could fly into the eye of God on high.
His burning eye will see me through.
One these days, one these days, one these days.
His burning eye will see me through.
One these days, one these days, one these days.
Upon release, Lodger would be panned by many critics as a footnote to Heroes. But with time, respect for the album has grown, with it being considered as the third part in a legendary series of albums often referred to as the Berlin Trilogy, despite only one of the three albums actually being recorded there. It's also hard to deny the influence of Lodger's world music explorations on albums like Talking Heads Remain in the Light or Paul Simon's Graceland. Here's David Byrne talking about the impact of Bowie on his career.
When David Bowie came along, rock and roll needed a shot in the arm. And when I first saw him, it was a shock, and yet it was very familiar. It was very necessary. It was something that was needed. It was essential. And like all rock and roll, it was visionary. It was tasteless. It was glamorous. It was perverse. It was fun. It was crass. It was sexy. It was confusing.
In fact, many artists who had grown up listening to Bowie were now nipping at his heels. As Lodger struggled on the charts, a young acolyte of his music named Gary Numan was out Bowieing Bowie with his smash hit, Cars. When asked about the hottest artist in 1979, Bowie snarkily replied, "I've seen his videos. To be honest, I never meant for cloning to be a part of the 80s. He's not only copied me, he's clever and he's got all of my influences too." The two were actually booked to perform on the Kenny Everett Show in late 79, but Bowie refused to be in the same studio at the same time as Numan. Here's Numan addressing the comparisons between him and Bowie.
Did it worry you about the Bowie thing? I mean, that where people, because the critics started saying, "Oh, Gary's like a David Bowie," you know?
Yeah. No, not really, because it was just a matter of time. Because now we go that way and he goes that way, and it's just a matter of time before it was obvious. But I suppose initially you have to expect that, because people see makeup and they think, "Oh, makeup is David Bowie,"
right?
And they can see no more. And as soon as you've been around for a while and you accept it in your own right, then they see the differences.
Bowie wasn't so quick to dismiss the comparisons. A year later, he released the song Teenage Wildlife with a scathing attack on Numan in the second verse.
Broken nose, broken lies, yo. One of the
Other bands stole from Bowie more blatantly, like The Associates, who scored a hit song when they recorded a cover of Boys Keep Swinging only months after the same song had been released on Lodger.
When you're a boy, you can wear a uniform. When you're a boy, other boys will check you out. You get a girl. When you're a boy,
to try and counter the youth movement and reinvigorate sales of the struggling lodger, RCA Records began a marketing campaign with the slogan, "There's a new wave, there's an old wave, and there's David Bowie." In December of 1979, David appeared on Saturday Night Live to promote the album, complete with vinyl spacesuits, puppetry, and a poodle. The performance remains one of the strangest, most avant-garde stage shows to ever grace the 30 Rock stage. Here's SNL alumni Fred Armisen discussing the memorable performance.
When I was in high school and living in Long Island, I stayed up to see David Bowie play on Saturday Night Live. And watching him was, for me, a life-changing experience. He had these backup singers that were like choir singers from the future, and a toy poodle with a TV monitor in his mouth. David Bowie transformed whatever space he was in, whatever medium he was using, and that night for me, he transformed live television.
That night transformed live television for many people. Blondie keyboardist Jimmy Destri would later say about the SNL performance, "That night, Bowie opened the gates to the 80s. He sniffed out the new wave and fashioned the new look." David was also prepared to take the 80s by storm with the release of Scary Monsters in early 1980, an album that many consider to be his last perfect album. Bowie doubled down on his vision of where the music industry was going by creating an elaborate music video for the song Ashes to Ashes. It's a song that revisits the character Major Tom. MTV wouldn't exist for another year, but Bowie insisted that the production for the video be top-notch.
Say it's true.
They got a message from the Action Man.
I'm happy. Hope you're happy too. I've loved all of needed love. Saw the details fall away. The shrieking when nothing is killing. Just pictures of Jap girls in synthesis. And I ain't got no money and I ain't got no help. But I'm hoping to kick with the gladiators glowing. Ashes to ash and fuck to fuck it. We know Major Tom's a junkie, strung out in heaven's high, hitting a
The video for Ashes to Ashes would debut on BBC and help make it Bowie's first number one hit in the UK since Fame 5 years earlier. The album Scary Monsters received more positive reviews than Lodger had, yet Bowie still felt snubbed by a music industry more interested in younger artists. Blondie, a band that once opened for him on tour, was now topping the charts with their hit song Call Me. The Talking Heads had one of the best-selling albums of the year with Remain in the Light, an album indebted to Lodger's tribal sounds. And the hottest new underground band in 1980 was Joy Division, a one-time punk band that reinvented itself into a moody post-punk group, a change that was inspired by Bowie's transformation a decade earlier. It could be argued that Bowie was being a bit of a poor sport and should have been basking in the influence he was about to have on an entire decade of music. Instead, he felt hurt, underappreciated, and abandoned for the youth movement. Bowie goes into hiding on the next Year of the Bowie.
Procession moves on, the shouting is over. Praise to the glory of loved ones now gone. Talking aloud as they sit round their tables, scattering flowers washed down by the